We will bring the Transportation Committee back to order. I would like to note that we now have with us Representative McBride and Senator Halpert. Join us, Rick. We will be discussing further this afternoon. The main issue this afternoon will have to do primarily with personnel matters. And Mark, if you're ready to take over on that one, well, we'll turn it over to you. Unless, Senator, you have a comment, anybody?
I might preface that by explaining something on our part. At this juncture, we see that there are at least three major issues that are large enough that we would like a more definitive sense of how they're going to be resolved before the transfer team actually goes ahead and makes a recommendation through Commissioner Casey to the governor in turn to the state about whether to acquire the railroad. One of them is the question of unfunded pension liabilities. A second is the issue of native land claims, which we discussed this morning. And a third deals with the issue of terms for compensation for the $22 million price tag. The transfer statute specifies the state has to agree to compensate the federal government for this level of compensation. It does not in any way speak to the form that compensation should take. And based on discussions we've had with primarily USDOT, which is the primary federal agency in the transfer, they agree that that gives the state and the federal government significant latitude to discuss how those arrangements would actually be worked out. Our sense is that primarily with those three issues, we've been asked to put a push on during the next month, by the end of November, to reach resolution, if at all possible, in all three areas, or at least provide much greater specificity to the problem. And it's one of the things that we are now moving ahead on. We have initiated discussions with the FRA about the question of terms. We're talking to some of our other agencies, as well as some of the other federal agencies, about possible arrangements that, for example, could be in lieu of cash payments, or the possibility of deferred cash arrangements tied to ESRA's assessment of when the railroad starts making money, that type of thing.
Let me interject a question right at this point, Mark. Now, we talk about in lieu of, has there been any specific comments made about anything specifically they would take in trade?
No, not specifically. I would point out that there are some question areas, real property question areas that involve the railroad. The transfer report itself that was put out in July mentions these. The military, for example, has some concern about the type of authorities the state will have with the right-of-way in the military reservations, arrangements between, they would like arrangements between the state and the military to ensure that they have adequate protection for security interests. And frankly, I think they would prefer to limit some of the types of uses that we could put that right-of-way to.
If I can interject, the uses they want to limit have nothing to do with the major corridor uses which the state would need. They have more to do with public access. There not includes about, you know, tour buses coming off at the end of the runway so foreign tourists can take pictures of the F-15.
Oh.
It's that kind of security and access requirements they're concerned about. Whether or not they're willing to compensate us for some kind of security easement, if you will, is something that we get to discuss with them. But if they are, you know, it's one option that we presented for legislation to the governor, and maybe if something would come off.
Our negotiations is broad on the terms of the payment of the $22 million to encompass something like a trade for unfunded liabilities versus cash layout on the $22 million.
Well, there has been some discussion of that relationship with it, and we need to get into the unfunded question because there's some options available to the state to minimize the impact. But the answer to your question is that on the federal side, USRA took into account the problem associated with the state having to pay more for the pension system than otherwise would be the case, and that's why the number is what it is. If that pension problem hadn't been there, the number would have been $44 million. So that, I don't think that...
It's kind of a wash then. They've already handled it.
I don't think there's much opportunity there. I do think there's... it'll depend, but then this military is just an example I raised where if we can come to some accommodation that we think is reasonable for protecting the railroad and the kind of uses that we want that corridor to be able to put to, and at the same time there's a way to equate that, I mean the value associated with it, to minimize the cash nature of the $22 million figure, it seems worth looking into. Obviously, in the end, all of that would be subject to the legislature reviewing and approving. In the unfunded liability area, just probably to preface the remarks, it might be helpful to go back to what creates the problem. Under the statute, we have two options available to the state in terms of how we take care of the railroad employees transferred to the state in their retirement benefit area. Under option one, we can leave, and we have 2 years after data transfer to make a decision about it. Under option one, essentially we leave all transferring employees in the federal system. They essentially remain full participants in the federal system, and benefits are paid as they have been in the past as part of the federal arrangements. The state becomes the employer for purposes of contributions, so in effect becomes what the Alaska Railroad has been. And the new state-owned railroad would take on that role, more likely. The problem with the federal system is that agencies that participate by statute only required to pay a certain level of contribution that is matched by all employees, and it's been set in time for some time. It's 7% employer contribution, 7% employee contribution. It earns some interest. Well, in the last 10 years, with inflationary effects, the federal system nationwide had a large unfunded problem. And there have been major attempts to rectify this that haven't really gone anywhere yet, legislatively, to start a process of getting the system back into shape. Currently, the people that deal with this, the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, estimate that to have a fully solvent system, you need what is a level of 36% contributions rather than 14%. So it leaves what it comes down to a 22% problem that's not being taken care of, again, all system-wide. Well, if the state were to elect option one, what has happened is the Federal Office of Personnel Management, in reading the transfer statute, suggests at data transfer, while we would simply have to take on the role of the railroad, no longer would we be only required to pay 7%. We have to make up the unfunded difference, an additional 22%. And it's that 22% is what is referred to as the unfunded problem.
That's 22% of what?
Of gross salaries.
Of the gross salaries themselves.
Now, can I ask you a question? This 36% is nationwide.
That's correct. System average.
When we get down to it, we won't know whether that unfunded portion as it relates to the state of Alaska is enough or too much or anything else.
Well, this is one of the problem areas. That's correct. The first part of the answer, though, is that doesn't matter. The OPM deals with system-wide averages only. And as such, what you're getting at is that the actuarial makeup of the railroad specifically and the level of contributions they paid in versus what ongoing liabilities there is and what's being paid in doesn't really matter to OPM, because all they claim is that we have to make up the amount they determine to be the unfunded problem system-wide. they don't have a system that will allow them to consider specific case examples of the railroad. The issue, though, becomes when you look, start looking at option two, the question you ask is much more relevant because it then deals with the specific actuarial makeup of the railroad rather than dealing with the system of equation. Option two allows the state to take these people out of the federal system and place them into a new system that is to be substantially equivalent to the state's retirement system.
The type we've got with APEA and so forth now.
That's the exact statutory language, substantially equivalent. Mm-hmm. In doing so, we are allowed to withdraw all contributions to date which have been made for by the employees and the employer.
That's out of the federal system?
Out of the federal system. And accrued interest.
Which is essentially 14% plus.
Which is only 14% plus. So for at least the last 10 years, you've had a growing liability problem that essentially under option two, not only do we buy into an ongoing problem by taking these people and taking them out, but we now have a back year problem. Another way to say that is that the 14% withdrawing is not anywhere sufficient to reflect what really should have been contributed for those periods of years. The reason that's not a problem under option one is that as long as they stay in the federal system, all of the liability that accrued from related to the period of federal ownership of the railroad remains a federal liability. And what happens today is that anything that's attributable to the back year problem is simply made up out of the Treasury or by general payment
by the United States.
By the United States.
Yeah. And that's really the reason why the number, the unfunded pension number, varies so much.
It's got two basic numbers we're looking at.
Yeah, there's two options.
Okay, on this first one then, are we looking at the $68 million?
Now you're getting to the estimates that have been put together so far.
Yeah, well, this is what I'm talking about, the estimates
that
we have.
The $68 million by OPM relates to option one.
Okay, now the second figure is a higher figure.
That's correct, and what it really represents is, there's some, as we can go into this, there's an awful lot of assumptions that you have to make to work on this. One of the assumptions is that everybody's transferring. Which seemed about the only way you could deal with it. In reality, we know that with early retirement, that was probably not the case. But for purposes of coming up with numbers, they assume, as of today, these salary levels, everybody transfers. $68 million is the problem. Under option one, for the state, the day of transfer on, to make up this extra 22%. Under option two, they had no way of assessing the state system at the level of benefits, which is the operative standard. So they assume that the state system was the federal system. Try and come up with a number. And that's a large assumption that may not be correct, if I can finish it. They came up with an estimate of $142 million being the unfunded liability, the present value figure of the unfunded liability. Because what it is that it's the $68 million from day one of transfer on, plus they went back and determined, assuming equivalent level of benefits on a federal scale, what was the problem for these people going back to these years where the contribution levels should have been higher but were not? And they came up with an estimate of $73 million in back year problems that if we were to take all these people out, and if this is 73, this is a net figure, they factored in the 14% contribution we get, and then deducted, came up with a total problem. And factor that in, what the net liability for back years is $73 million present value, which is where you come up with, you add the two together, and they come up with an estimate of $142 million being the present value cost associated with the problem.
But, if I can interject, that is an absolute worst case scenario. That assumes, take the option where everybody transfers, that take everything out of the federal system, that nobody quits, that everybody stays to maximum retirement, and after retirement lives the full amount of years that an actuary says that people ought to live in this day and age. So in one sense, it's a real number, but we have to put it in context of the fact that it's absolutely the worst possible case, and may not affect the rule that we're going to have to take that option.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, one thing to add, too, is that, again, these are OPM's numbers, and the Mercer folks are going to help nail this down.
You refer to Mercer. Who in the hell is Mercer?
Mercer is the firm which the state has, the State Department Administration has under contract, that is the state's actuary for our retirement system. We have negotiated an amendment to their contract to assist the transfer team to review this whole issue, review what OPM has done, and most specifically, start answering some of these questions that only someone familiar with our system can tell us. The one thing I wanted to add, though, is that it builds off of Dave's comment, is all these numbers are to some extent sort of funny numbers. The more I've learned about this, is that you talk to clients and the actuaries, and they all sort of have a different number. And the figure, let's accept the $68 million figure, just to talk about it, it isn't that the state has to go pay $68 million a day to take care of it. What that is a cumulative present value estimate of what you're looking at. What, in fact, the state has to pay is in year one that we take transfer, which would be the highest level of, the highest benefit that we would have to pay out, we would be faced with $4.5 million extra contribution that is paid today, which is about $1.5 million. So we would have to, in year one, pay $4.5 million to take care of this. That's the 22%. In year two, it would decrease slightly because of people leaving. And over a span of 30 to 40 years, you have that type of, a figure that you would be looking at in terms of annual impact to operating the railroad. I think that's important to...
Any other questions?
Mark, I was talking to an accountant friend of mine at Coopers & Lybrand, and he said there is a feature of Coopers & Lybrand of actuaries that have done railroad actuarial analyses before. And what I wanted to know was, can Mercer handle this job? Are there particular features of railroad employees that would require a specialist into coming up with this number that Mercer would not be able to do? I mean, is the fact that there are specialists out there for railroad actuarial analyses, can Mercer handle it?
It's a good point. I don't. Part of the answer is that there are a series of special statutes, federal statutes, which deal with railroad employees, Railroad Retirement Act, Labor Act, and such. The Alaska Railroad and the federal agency has never been covered or been subject to these laws. It is essentially, it's sort of a unique creature, but basically these people are government service employees, and that is the federal civil service participants. So it's much more of a government exercise for the federal side. Under the transfer, the federal statute clearly specifies that as long as this railroad remains an instrumentality of the state, that is defined in the bill, authority would qualify. If you start getting into leasing the management or selling it, then that would be a different issue. But as long as it remains an instrumentality of the state, these exemptions from all of these acts continue to apply. So, for our purposes right now, most of that question of the railroad side of it is not that critical. To evaluate, there is a critical element, though, in trying to evaluate the private ownership scenario, to be sure that at that point we're going to need to know what that means in dollars and cents, and we no longer have those exemptions. We'll talk to Mercer. It may be that they'll need to go to somebody that has this familiarity to help them answer that.
Mark, we're talking only of the pension benefits. We're not talking about medical or other insurance or other bennies that are. But essentially, the person who works for the railroad today is like someone who might work for the Department of the Interior. Have the same pension plan, the same benefits in terms of leave, annual leave, sick leave, and we have to assume all of those, right?
We have to assume all of those, and the answer to your question is that basically that's true, that they are as if they were working for our interior. Not entirely. They do, the the five unions that represent the employees in the railroad, with the exception of some management people, who are straight civil service employees. The government, the administrative types are very much more as if they were just the people working for Interior. The operators, the UTU people, for example, engineers, trade operators and such, do have collective bargaining agreements, and part of those agreements have a series of provisions, pay scales, work rules, a host of things that are unique.
What I was referring to were the benefits, not necessarily the
benefits
collective bargaining, the workplace rules and the pay scales and so on, but the benefits that follow are essentially civil service benefits.
That's correct.
Okay, then what we would really, from just looking at the straight pension, if we were to use the option of rolling into the state system, we would be looking at about the same as you would if a municipality is rolling into the public employee's retirement system. It would be essentially the same set of circumstances. The actuarial company, the people who are doing actuarial studies would have to look at.
Yeah. I think that's exactly correct. Obviously, they have to look, in doing that, they have to look at what they have as federal.
What's going to roll in.
And whether there's a diminution in the level of benefits and what that, and there's some unique case law situations in Alaska, that I understand, that have to be factored into that. But that's the analysis.
That's true, but one of the factors that works in it is, of course, the age of the average age or whatever it is of the personnel, and I have no idea what that is in the railroad system. But they also then make an assumption that the turnover rate, retirement versus additional hire and so on, and they set a rate then that the unit, municipality, railroad would have to pay, whether it's 15%, 18% plus what the employee pays.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall, the retirement system in the state takes about 23% or 24% of the gross wage when you count the employee's contribution.
Including the employee's contribution.
Including the employee's contribution. It's something about a quarter.
My
and you're saying 16, that the federal was 36. The state share would be 16 or 17.
16 is the 12% state, 4.25 is the we did not research this for the USCA people. Right now it's running 16 or a little over 16% as the total.
Well, that's even better yet. What I'm trying to do is say, here's Fed saying 36 total to keep their system going. And the state's for the workforce of the state, realizing there's going to be a separate unit that's going to have to stand by itself,
mm-hmm.
if it's handled like a municipality.
But the downside of that, obviously, is trying to assess what this back year problem, if you can go that option.
Well, you have to. You have to give people all the services they're getting.
How that factors in, on the surface, those percentage rates. I would make that same analysis, but from what I gather, what people can tell us, until they've done the work, jumping to the conclusions is something that we can caution not to do. Are these options pretty straightforward? What I'm thinking about is, obviously, that 22% that we're lacking, the way it stands, you come up with 36%. As you stated before, would be picked up by the federal government. Is there any room for negotiation to say that they pick up part of what they would have picked up anyway if they would have, or maybe all of them, if they didn't accept the
resolution?
There most definitely is. This is the next step really is. the options are fairly clearly set forward, but in the case of the first option, we leave these people in, what happens? We have found three precedents of agencies that have come out of the federal government and become one's the Pennsylvania Avenue Development Corporation, another one's the Farm Credit Bank, the third one is Fannie Mae, and they've been set up in different quasi-governmental corporations or broken off from the federal government. In each case, they have similar, in fact, almost verbatim statutory language which dealt with the retirement question. OPM, we talked about this, and they agreed that they exact same situation. In all those three cases, they had to deal with this issue of whether they up to the percentage rate contribution or not. But in all three cases, OPM decided not to do that. They decided to allow these people to remain at 70% for a range of reasons. A few years ago, OPM wasn't dealing with the unfunded problem with too much attention, smaller group of people, and they didn't want to impact the budget. Those are the kinds of explanations. OPM fully admits that what they're asking with the Alaska Railroad is a discretionary matter, and that they could ask us only to maintain the same level or negotiate something in between. Also, that the director of OPM, who has the decision, he is the person vested in this power, has not made a decision on this. The decision has been made today by someone who's pretty well down the ladder, and it's clear to us that there is an option here to attempt to work out an arrangement for working with our delegation that for purposes of transfer leaves us at 7%, and if the Congress goes in and amends the percentage relationships later and they go up, that's one thing we can buy into that at that time, but at least for purposes of the transfer, 7% would be what would be required. And we have, we feel we have a strong argument. We also have a case history when we were negotiating the issue over the last 2 years in Washington, the Federal Railroad Administration. Both FRA and the state felt that was what we were talking about. And under option one, we would only have to continue the same level of contribution. Nobody at all talked about an unfunded problem. And we met with FRA yesterday, and they're willing to ask Secretary Dole to write a letter to help us.
So now if we took option is there a possibility that we take out two only if they pick up what they are now behind?
We reviewed that also from a legal point of view. Attorneys tell us that we're on much deeper ground. Normally what happens is when people come out of the system individually, they don't even get the employer contribution 7%. They don't get what they put in. But because this is a full transfer, OPM was willing to allow the 7-7 at interest.
The pie that it showed us this morning, where it showed so much for 84, 85, 86, that figures in a 36%.
That's correct. Now,
that assumes we can't reach any other accommodation.
Yeah, okay. That's the way I understood it.
Yeah, and they acknowledged in the report that this isn't nailed down yet, but they had to come out with a number just like the native claim issue, and here's the number. It is important to point out that USRA, they started from the same base information OPM did. They went to OPM and they got all this, they looked at it. And they valued the present value, they determined the present value of the personnel problem and came up with a much different number. They came up with a figure of about $22 million. There's two main reasons. Extensively that explain why. Again, that's about as best as we know right now. The Mercer people are trying to help us figure out where we're at. OPM used a very low discount rate, 6% discount rate to determine present value, which is low. USRA used a 16%, which for purposes of this analysis may be high, but what USRA said is that they wanted to factor in what the cost to the state would be to take care of this problem. And $68 million put out on the table today, invested, is going to earn more than 6% on that money. Therefore, that discount rate they felt was not fair. Also, OPM used, they did their analysis of current dollars, and they factored in an annual 5% salary cost of living adjustment for their base scale. USRA did not do that because they did their analysis of cost of dollars, and it wouldn't have been appropriate. They would, their explanation at that point would be that as long as they didn't do it in revenue, as long as they were consistent, revenue expense, it all should still basically wash out. And they also try to pick some of that up in their discount factor. Those are the two main reasons it's a different number. But it suggests that OPM or USRA may have understated the full extent of the problem. It's clear that OPM has overstated it. And hopefully the Mercer people are going to tell us what we think the real figure is.
Other questions at the moment? Really confused now. Now let's figure out. So no matter how we slice it, we're gonna get stuck with $68 million anyway, aren't we?
No, not at all. I clearly feel that is an inaccurate estimate.
All right, $22 million. How does that sound?
$22 million is right. And even if we were able to obtain this interpretation, people have to realize that it may only be good for so many years. Congress could come in and modify this, and the statute changes, and what is 7% goes up to 11%, or goes up to 14%. And if the federal system itself has a major problem at some point along the line, the state's the underwriter for the last railroad employee, and in the end, if something were really to get into a problem situation, the state, it would be walking into this liability.
Mark, let's say we get the best case scenario and they let us go in for 7% and that's solid. What is that liability? What would be our first year liability at 7% for all the employees to match?
The first year contribution, or if you were to do that in 83, would be $1.5 million. It is no additional liability, though. It is what the railroad today, out of its generated earnings, pays.
It'd show up in their operating.
Sure. So that's what it would be. So we could go as, in the worst case, we could be 68, and in the very, very best case, we could be 1.5.
Right.
$83. What, can't we narrow it down a little tighter than that?
I don't think we can today. I hope that after we talk with OPM, we can get some kind of reading from them on two tracks. First of all, whether what exactly is the range? What are the numbers? And secondly, how will they feel about taking the option, best option from our point of view, and that is to just have the state continue to pay the 7% as opposed to the feds, and then let the system remain where it is and let the unfunded portion remain where it is. The other thing that I think makes that option more attractive, at least from my personal point of view, is that even if 5 years from now or 10 years from now, the employer's contribution goes up. So instead of paying 7, we're paying 11, or we're paying whatever. That's a finite, there's a back end period of time on that, because all the new employees for the railroad wouldn't go into the federal system, they'd go to our system, which we control. So we're talking essentially about making a contribution during that period of time which current employees are still working and still under the plan. So we're not tying, we're not tying this in for generations, we're tying it for the rest of our generation.
Right.
But isn't that the case with any retirement system? It's always in a state of flux as far as the annual actuarial. Now, generally, it'll only maybe be 0.1% or something like that. It'll go up or down. It could actually go down depending on the age that's happened during the year. But all retirement systems have a that are actuarially sound have a floating contribution.
That's very correct and really important, Senator. The point I was trying to get to specifically is that if we wind up with what on the short range is the best solution, that is having employees in the federal system, we're not getting ourselves into a situation where we have no control of the employers here forever. The feds can decide totally hard that we want to raise that, but it's only going to be for a finite period of years.
Senator, if I could add to Senator Banks' question, we confirmed talking to the owner this morning, the Mercer people will have something to us definitely by November 30th, and hopefully some of it even before. We have a deadline imposed to have as much of this together in these areas, one way or the other, by that time period, so that the decision, the recommendation on our part can be made that the governor can then work with. And at the same time, we are going to start the discussion of OPM actively. Probably have the governor put out a letter to OPM explaining our point of view and requesting reconsideration of allowing us to be treated at the 7% level. So we're going to pursue that actively too in the next year.
What's the railroad employee's retirement year? Is it an age, or is it 20 years of service, 25 years of service? What's their, to give me a handle on this retirement, this finite number here that we'd be under the federal system?
They, I need to go back to the mayor and stuff. We've got a couple people here that can help. 62 is an age retirement. They have options for early retirement. They also have a years of service.
Is it 20 years? 30 years?
30 and 55.
30 and 55.
30 and 55.
The normal retirement, or at 62 you have to.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
No, not necessarily.
No.
If you convert to the federal system, it's 50 years.
50? You've been there 50 years, did you say?
15.
Oh.
15 years. You've got to work federal government 15 years, or then you go at 60.
Thank you. One other question while we're talking about personnel end of it here. What effect will the accrued annual and sick leave have on employees that stay with the railroad if the state takes it over?
Under the statute, we have an obligation to provide that protection.
Well, how about the accrued sick leave? I'm talking about the accrued end of it now, not the sick leave that becomes beneficial to them after the state takes over. Is there a fine line in here that we need to know about, or what?
That falls essentially under the, we need to get those exact numbers, which I don't have today, and they may be in tomorrow's reports. But the employees carry that along with them as essentially part of their rights under the bargaining agreement, which is in full force in effect.
But we're looking at, are we looking at $1.5 million that they're entitled to now that we know of? I'm looking at a letter that came from, Mark, you wrote it, in fact, to Ben Harding. And I see a figure here of $1.5 million. Is that $1.5 million that they are presently entitled to, or is that an estimated amount?
An estimate that was out of the transfer report that was put together. The actual date on that, I think, would have been late spring of this year. That is a fluid figure, and that's accrued actual, which is that is what we would be required to transfer to occur at that time. We have responsibility for that level of benefit, as it's indicated. We put a number in so that there could be some representative sense. Yeah.
Well, the point I'm making is that seems to me like that is an obligated debt from the civil service end of it, or the railroad end of it.
During the federal period of ownership.
During the federal period of ownership.
The problem with it is, Senator, if I can inject it, that if it were $1.5 million and on the date of transfer all the employees were going to cash out, then there isn't any question that we would have said the feds ought to pick that up. But if we're talking about, as I think we will be in the vast majority of cases, accrued sick leave and accrued vacation leave, there isn't any real way to charge that back against the federal government. If employee has 2 weeks of vacation coming for this last year and schedules to take it July 1 when we take over the railroad, there's no real way to have the federal government pick that up by sending in another person to work for it.
Well, is there a time element there, a month, 30 days, year, 2 years, end of a contract or anything that would be involved if they took it all up at one time? The point I'm trying to get at is that do we need to put $1.5 million in the kitty somewhere, set it aside, just in case this comes up immediately upon transfer of the railroad?
I don't believe so, no. We can get back to you on that by looking at the collective bargaining agreement, but I don't...
I'm not sure. I don't know that much about the bargaining agreement. That's probably what I'm asking about is some of the details on it.
We can get back with an answer. The one thing to point out, many of those, the annual leave, for example, is an obligation that the railroad covers as a result of this revolving fund account. And the way that the transfer statute is set up, that at the date of transfer, the state and FRA sits down and sort of does a tallying exercise. And to the extent that their liabilities, which are attributable to federal ownership, then X amount of money is retained by the federal government. We don't really have any control over that to cover it, or in lieu of that, they'll leave it in the revolving account, and we accept that obligation.
Okay, but as I understand it here, you've got $4.5 million that will come over in the revolving account to cover some of these things that maybe we're talking about right now and don't even need to worry about.
It's real hard, unfortunately, to explain exactly what would come over, because that includes all the employee areas as well as tort obligations, or some tort obligations, a series of other kinds of things, which, frankly, we had always assumed that there would be very little in the revolving account. One of the reasons that we suggested to us was they include a consideration for a working capital fund. And if you look in the report, one of their startup costs is $4.5 million in the first year, on the basis that to continue operations, the state would have to put that right in. And I think that's reasonable.
Well, in the, I can't remember which page it was on, but when it showed revenue, railroad revenue, I'm assuming that included money that they might have estimated that they had in their revolving account to be carried from one year to the next. Or was that straight?
Oh, no, carry from one year. Oh, correct.
Carry money.
And it's important to point out that you know, all these, the payroll and such, is something which is covered yearly as a part of operating revenue generating cash flow. Now we also have been able to determine that when compared elsewhere, pay scales are on the high end compared elsewhere in the rail industries and things like that, which is part of the exercise we're going to have to look at renegotiating collective bargaining agreements.
In your studies, have you looked at the way the federal government has negotiated with the Criminal Office of St. Paul and St. George? Some of these things are similar things, and I thought maybe there might be some ideas that we might be in there really recent.
Not directly. They actually were sort of behind us in terms of the process, and they've come to us on a couple of occasions from Key Regional Affairs and asked us some questions. Point that so maybe there are some very clearly some similar situations occurring. So much of what governs this process is a matter of the statute. The statute went through a long 2-year process with an awful lot of different people thinking out areas, you know, whether you like a particular solution or not. It usually was an attempt to try and, by statute, say this is how it's going to be dealt with. I think some of these other situations don't have that kind of. It helps set the framework.
Gotcha. Okay. Next item.
Okay. The only other item that we were going to offer presentation on, and you may want to go through some other questions first. There's some work that we have started on a staff level in terms of the operating entity question. Perhaps before we go into that, you may have other questions about.
Okay, before we get into that, there's another fairly high-cost item that perhaps, I don't know whether you're ready to talk about it or not. It has to do with full compliance with the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA. We're looking at $55 to $95 million. Perhaps we need to take a look at that and see what...
That's a number which The memo you're speaking to is one that I...
I realize that, but...
...was part of, and we put together in the summer in an attempt to put some numbers down to offer some of the governor's staff people a sense of where things were at. And as we indicated in several footnotes, I think the memo is one page long and the footnotes are 2 pages long. A lot of these are soft. In the OSHA area specifically, we have not... The railroad, as a agency, the Department of Transportation, has been in a long controversy, as other federal agencies, with the question of jurisdiction by OSHA over the property. And there is a sort of mixed case situation where they let OSHA come in on certain things and they don't let them in on other things. The state's never had a responsibility for these people. As soon as we got along in the transfer process, we approached labor to get some help. We were able to do a quick walkthrough in the anchorage yard to see the extent of the problem, and then essentially needed to budget for more funds this year to do something. We just received the final authorization this week and are hoping to continue some OSHA work. Unfortunate problem is that the people to do this aren't available to do the kind of work we need because of other commitments. And we would essentially have to contract, and we need probably about $100,000 in addition to the $100,000 we set aside to properly do an assessment of what we're looking at in OSHA problems. As a result, one of the things we're trying to do is we're working with the federal government to see if they'd be willing to help us at no additional cost. But all that means is that there are soft numbers. The railroad does keep an ongoing document on this. They suggest their problem. 2 years ago, they suggested their problem was about $10 million, just OSHA-related, and that they are doing, for example, this year, they did a project with their maintenance shops in Anchorage, about $2.5 million to rectify it. Beyond that, USRA took into account, using the railroad's records, a factor for having to cover OSHA-related problems. It's a very low number, $2.5 million.
That was five. Hmm? That was five.
Over 5 years.
Yeah.
Well, over 5 years, right? That's low. We don't know the extent of the problem.
Mark, I think some of that USRA number came from situation like, and I'm not going to get the terminology right because the language of railroading is not my language. The tunneling at Whittier, there's a lookout there, or there's a man that sits there, and he's two stories up. And OSHA requirements say that if you're a federal employee in a building and there's more than two stories, you have to have an elevator. And now there's a set of stairs going up there, and I don't think any of us are going to put an elevator in Whittier Tunnel for the engineer, whoever climbs up there. So some of those OSHA requirements have to be looked at very realistically in railroad language, in railroad talk. And so I hope we keep that in mind, because I don't think we want to put an elevator in the Whittier Tunnel.
That's exactly correct. And the where it comes out question. Clearer is you look at the what makes up this large number, 55 to 95, is the basis of an effort the state contracted for to have a group of people go out and do a conceptual walkthrough, a conceptual estimate based on an inspection of all railroad buildings, of violations of state and local building codes. And you have some overlap because you have some OSHA-type problems that are also building code violations. They went through without any instructions to look at it as if they were operating the railroad. They were asked to simply give us a sense of what the outside exposure might be. And the result of their work came out with an estimate around $80 to $90 million of problems. We actually even went in and had a second cost estimator go over that material and do another estimate because we really wanted to make sure that we had something we were comfortable with. Those numbers, a couple things go into it. Part of it is code, and part of it is condition. As a matter of fact, 40% of the number is code and about 60% is condition. And it's this notion where you have somebody who comes in and says, to do it absolutely right, it ought to be like this. And in most cases, the reason the number is quite high is that the only sensible thing you would do with some of these facilities is tear them down and rebuild them because it's too costly to renovate them. Well, the thing that wasn't assessed, and it's something we're looking at, and exactly what USRA has already done, is functionally, in terms of each one of these facilities, do they serve a purpose still for the railroad or not? And in some cases, many cases actually, one example that comes to bear right now is that the Whittier Transit Shed, which basically is not used by the railroad and hasn't been for some time, is one of the large ticket items in our report, $15 million. to rebuild it. Well, it's not clear if there's not a functional need for it, that a railroad is going to commit to go in and rebuild it. USRA sat down, they looked at our information, went through it from a railroad point of view, talked to the railroad, and came up with their figure of, I think, about $15 million of problems, and that's what they put into their report. And the methodology is very reasonable. One of the things we're doing right now is I've got some people that are doing that same exercise and talking to USRA, and I tend to think that that's probably a much more reasonable estimate for the kinds of problems in the building code area and partially OSHA than the numbers and conceptual estimates.
Even in the conceptual estimates, weren't they putting water and sewer restrooms in some of these sheds, these Hinderland buildings out there that were just tool sheds, but they didn't have a restroom in it? So conceivably, an employee has to have a restroom.
And it's important to point out that, I mean, that was their instructions, because one of the things we did with that document is we shipped it off to USRA and said, take it into account. And you know, we are living somewhat with the backlash of doing that kind of exercise that way.
Yeah, you were very effective in scaring everybody about these OSHA stuff, this OSHA stuff.
Hope we weren't too effective, Senator. That really is the crux of the problem. Like, as it would be in any transaction, when you start talking purchase price, if you're going to err in terms of liabilities, you always err on the high side. And now that we have the number out, it's time, and when Mark says the numbers are soft, I know he doesn't mean, and no one should infer from the statement, that he means that the number is in any way illusory. It's a real number. It's a real number for going through and taking every one of those buildings and bringing them absolutely up to OSHA. But now our focus shifts, because now as a prudent buyer in terms of what we're going to do, we may decide to tear the tool shed down and spend $1,000 doing that rather than spend $20,000 getting it up to OSHA standards. It was not our job, and by that I mean all of us on the state side of the table, to point out other reasonable alternatives to OSHA compliance as the seller was preparing, you know, its packet, but to point out what OSHA compliance is going to be, assuming we operated it the way that the seller had operated. And now, you know, we're shifting gears. And it doesn't mean the first number is bad. It means that operationally we've got to decide whether we want to continue with the same assumptions that the old owner had.
It is clear there are problems in these areas, but if you, for example, use Dave's example, you take it one step further. By doing that exercise and tearing down some of those facilities and deciding that functionally they're not serving the purpose of the railroad, you also, in many of the cases of where these lands are, going to free up additional land for leasing, generating revenue income that's currently not being collected and is not part of the evaluation exercise that's been performed.
Senator Gilman? Again, on the Table 3, which is kind of the attempt to lay out these associated costs that we're talking about over a 10-year period of time, the first item that is listed is railroad forecast, revenue, railroad forecast expenditures. And that, I'm assuming, would be if the railroad was not being transferred and no other changes were being made. In other words, they would be anticipating a net cash flow of $10 million. And then there is an adjustment.
The better way of stating that, because that's not quite true. What the first three figures, or the net cash flow from the forecast, is the USRA, in doing this exercise, had to turn basically the railroad to get a starting point.
Yeah.
And the railroad's estimate without the capital.
Without capital, without.
That's an important aspect, is this number.
Yeah.
But the as you get into the second figures, USRA would say that continued federal operations would, in fact, generate the adjusted forecast.
In other words, there would have been an anticipation that if they were going to do those things, then there would have had to have been a $3.5 million, $3.6 million subsidy from the federal government.
Under federal operations.
Under federal operations.
That's right. I think it's also important that it's $3.5 million of additional subsidy in addition to the amount of flow to the pension that's funded the railroad revolving, any appropriation from the general treasury to the railroad revolving fund, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I don't know in this instance whether the those kind of appropriations were either A, listed at all, or B, listed as a revenue.
Okay. Now, what does MOW stand for?
That is maintenance away, and what
right
happened
away.
Is... Yeah,
is that the is that what we call that? The deferred maintenance that we...
No, it's not. I mean, it's tied to that, but maintenance away is a category of expenditure that's annually dealt with by railroads for in terms of projection of expenses, maintenance of equipment, maintenance of way, and capital.
Railroad ties.
And what happened is that these are the second category, the three figures, export coal, productivity, maintenance of way, represent the three major adjustments that USRA, based on their analysis, did to the railroad forecast. They looked at them, they looked at the expense forecast of the railroad. They said, given the anticipated level of traffic, you've not included a large enough expenditure for maintenance away, and they added in the figures that you see on a yearly basis. They did it by taking it out, but essentially they said, in the first year you're going to have $1.2 million more maintenance away expenses.
You've estimated.
This is essentially where the piper gets paid for the level of maintenance that's taken place over the last number of years, and I don't think there's ever been a safety hazard.
Well, the reason I'm raising it is that there's been a good deal of discussion about, quote, deferred maintenance, and that there is a